I will now officially bring the meeting to order. And our first order of business is to approve the subcommittee structure and the leadership within it that I think everybody has seen. We are very fortunate, and as you heard the president say, very pleased that so many of this country's business leadership has signed up for this task. And Ursula and I would just like to echo our appreciation for that. If this had turned into a meeting between me and Ursula, this would not nearly be as successful as it's going to be. So we appreciate that. We have a lot of experts with us today that have rolled up and advised us as we've initially begun to develop recommendations. I want to recognize them and thank them. Listen, the subcommittees and the leadership are in your book. I know we've all had a chance to see it, vet it, discuss it. I'm going to assume approval unless someone would like to jump into the fray. Is there any discussion there, or should we just move forward? So why don't we approve the committee and subcommittee structure and the membership therein. Now, before we get to the letters of recommendation that some of the subcommittees have already developed, I'd like to ask Ursula to make some comments, if you'd like, as she and I have been working together hand in glove since we started in March. And I love our teamwork, Ursula, so any comments would be appreciated.
I'll keep them very, very short. First, to give a huge hail to my chairman, to our chairman. Jim, who's actually carrying the heavy bucket of water. I actually just carry a small bucket of water. It's a privilege and an honor to serve as the vice chair, and I look forward to working with each and every one of you in this great and important endeavor. We have a lot of work to do. Today is the beginning of that work. Actually, we've had a lot of work before this, but today is the official beginning of that work. And it's all about meeting the president's goal of doubling exports in the next 5 years. 2X in five is what I say. The President's Export Council clearly can't do everything. We're not here to do everything. We're not going to attempt. But I know I speak for all of you here in that we can do a lot, and we can do it quickly. So I'm eager to get going, like I'm sure you are. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Ursula. Listen, before we get going and I turn the meeting over to Secretary Locke for some comments, I think I'd like to recognize some members of the Senate and Congress that are with us today. I know there's a little bit of a tight schedule, if there's any comments after recognition, we'd appreciate it. Senator Wyden. Yeah, there he is. Senator Wyden, it's wonderful to have you as part of this group. And would you care to make a comment, or should we?
Is it appropriate now to use your minute or two? Whatever's your pleasure.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead?
Colleagues, I think the president has clearly staked out important ground for us. And I just want to offer up one comment by way of our direction for our work. Too many times we are playing catch-up ball in important areas of international trade. And we saw an example of this just in the last week, and that is with the export of green goods. The president has identified this as a top priority. New information has just come to light that we continue to lag in this market. And to me, it is part of a pattern that indicates that where we have these fledgling, exciting industries, and they don't get treated fairly in global markets, we have got to get at it faster in order to make sure they get a fair shake. And you see example after example. Green goods is the one in the last couple of weeks. Ambassador Kirk is dealing with lumber in Canada. We have evidence of pervasive unfair treatment in global markets. We're trying to get the attention of the Customs Department. And in the trade subcommittee that I chair on the Senate Finance Committee, we're shortly going to have a hearing on discrimination against digital goods in global markets. This is an area, colleagues, where we have a huge lead in technology and the internet. And if we don't move faster, if we don't go on the offensive, in some of these areas, these promising sectors are going to find it hard to make the contribution we all want to see, the president doubling of exports in the next 5 years. And to me, this is not a question of picking winners and losers. It's simply a question of saying, when we have an industry and a sector that is clearly winning, let's have a trade policy so that instead of their hitting singles, they can hit more homers and we can use them as a trampoline for the president's objectives. So I very much appreciate this. Anything longer would be a filibuster, and I don't want to do that to colleagues. But I think getting on the offensive with respect to sectors that are fledgling, transformational, breakthrough opportunities to increase high-skill, high-wage jobs ought to be a priority. Thank you.
Exports without accompanying disciplines around trade eventually an empty exercise. And we'll take the point in the areas that you'd mentioned. Thank you for your comments. We have Senator Stabenow, who's with us, a tireless supporter of the mission here. And would you care to make a comment?
Well, Jim, yes, thank you. I will be brief. And to you and Ursula and to all of the members, it's wonderful that you are here, a part of this effort. We appreciate the President's vision and the Cabinet and their focus. Just share a comment from August in Michigan, spending time with our agricultural producers and processors, talking about ag exports and the opportunities there. And then Secretary Locke joined me in an overflow crowd at Automation Alley in Detroit, talking about the opportunities for small, medium-sized manufacturers and others. And there was great excitement. So I look forward to the opportunity for us to move forward and create jobs by creating more opportunities for exports. I do want to stress that in this area, and this is one that we have to work on very closely together, because it depends on the industry how we view our trade agreements and whether or not they're written right or not. But for me, and I come through a manufacturing lens, I want to make sure that this is done right so that when we create export opportunities, the door is open on the other end. And I know that we all want that. But when I was in China speaking at a Global Auto Leaders Summit a few months ago and met with our businesses there talking about China's indigenous innovation policy, closing the door to American businesses to sell to them, we can't let that stand. And we have a whole range of things. And I won't go into Korea and autos and manufacturing and so on, except to say it's got to work. These have to be right so that our businesses have the opportunity to sell. That's important. And finally, I would just say that Senator Lindsey Graham and I have been working on legislation relating to USTR that, among other things, would add a chief manufacturing negotiator to the table. We have right now by law, a chief agricultural negotiator. I think manufacturing ought to be specifically at the table as we move forward on agreements, whether it be the Doha round or any other agreements, and would hope that we would do that. I know from talking to Ambassador Kirk that certainly relates to resources, and I am very committed to supporting the USTR having the resources that they need to do that. But let's make sure the door is open on the other end. Let's make sure there's a level playing field so we can really make this happen. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments. Appreciate it. Senator Brown.
Thank you. And I would also thanks very much all of you for the role that you're playing and that you will play in doubling the nation's exports. There will be some differences, certainly, among all of us in trade policy, but where we can have agreement and mostly have agreement, I think, is on trade enforcement rules. This president, the first one in through presidents of both parties over the last several years, has been fairly aggressive in enforcing on tires, on the surge, on 421, on tires, on steel, on coated paper, Mr. Secretary. And that's all directly translated, sometimes literally within days of making these decisions, into jobs in my state and other states across the country. Not so long ago, I asked Larry Summers and Ron Blum, the president's chief advisor in manufacturing, to come to my office. I organized a group of bipartisan senators, about seven or eight of us, to talk about manufacturing. And Ron Blum said something pretty interesting. He said, all of America wants us to have more manufacturing, but nobody wants their kid to go into it. And I was talking to Ursula a minute ago about the work she's done on STEM. And if you know, we're the only major industrial power on Earth that doesn't have a real manufacturing policy, and it's not picking winners and losers, as Ron Wyden said. We, in many ways, picked finance as the winner many years ago in this country. We, 30 years ago, 25%, upwards of 25% of our GDP was manufacturing. Today, it's around 11 or 12%. We know how that creates a middle class and prosperity for this country, especially for workers who don't have a lot of higher education. And that's one reason it's so very, very important. I will close with this. As we look to figure out on everything from STEM to trade to taxes to the MEP program to help small manufacturers figure out how to export, how to cut costs, how to be more efficient. I was talking to a trade lawyer who was working on the coated paper case, and I said to him, this is an industry. This is a good example, briefly, of sort of what's happened. And as Ron Wyden would suggest, this is not as high a tech industry as some, but coated paper. China didn't have a coated paper industry 10 years ago. They began it 7 or 8 years ago. They import pulp from Brazil. They ship it to China. They process it, they sell it into Ohio and other states, and they undercut our manufacturers' prices. Somebody's gaming the system. It's not just labor costs and environmental costs that enable them to do that. So I was talking to the close of this. I was talking to this trade lawyer, and I said, that works on this case, and I said, do the Chinese kind of laugh at us that we are giving away our industrial base? And he said, no, they don't really laugh at us. They just think we're a declining empire. And I think back as the Chinese look at the world in a time a little differently from what we do. Some 35 years ago, a reporter asked Zhou Enlai, the Chinese premier, what he thought of the French Revolution. And he said, it's too early to tell. And, you know, I think that we need to pay a special attention to that trade relationship. I hear it from small manufacturers. I hear it from big companies all the time. And I hope this council, as we increase exports, can particularly do that, Jim. Thank you.
I appreciate those comments, and I think that resonates with a lot of us, and so we'll take it to heart. We have some of the House members of the group with us today, and I'd like to ask them for their comments, too. We have Linda Sanchez, Pat Teaberry, Mark Schauer, and Dave Reichert with us. Congressmen and women, would you care to make a comment? Perhaps Congressmen, yes, go ahead.
And go first. I too am from Ohio. I'll bookend Senator Brown, my senator, me a Republican, he a Democrat, but some of the things he said I completely agree with. Let me tell you a story, and I was telling the senator this. I had a group of farmers come in from Ohio yesterday, and they said to me, we're really excited about the President's State of the Union speech, about doubling exports. We think that's a great thing. But in Ohio in the last month, if you turn on the TV, you cannot get away without watching a political ad that bashes NAFTA, that bashes trade with China. And this is what the farmers are telling me, and obviously I've seen that. And they said to me, how do you double exports when the president's own members of his own party, whether it's the governor or the man running for the US Senate or members of Congress, are all saying that trade is bad? To which I said, well, I can't answer that question. Are you seeing Senator Brown later today? Maybe he can answer that question. But here's the point. There is a vacuum in our state, and I think the senator and I would agree that the majority of Ohioans think trade is bad, quite frankly. And the senator's views of what he just talked about are the views that average Ohioans have. Now, the facts may be different. They may be. But I got to tell you, I think it's up to the people around this table, the business community, the White House, to give a different story, if there is a different story to be told. Because the status quo among the hearts and minds of Ohioans, at least, is that trade's bad. I don't know how we get to a Korea when, quite frankly, in Ohio today, most Ohioans think that NAFTA has caused our job losses in the state, that CAFTA has caused job losses in our state. And there's been no leadership in the private sector to say that's wrong. The challenges are much greater than I think people in this room realize, and quite frankly, more challenging than the president realizes. If we're going to double exports, when most people are asking me, when are we going to repeal NAFTA? When are we going to go back and make it fair? So, and I'm a person who has voted for trade in the past, and I got to tell you, the playing field is changing rapidly before our eyes, and I hope the leadership of this group and the president provide at least a balance to what the senator so ably said is a status quo that most people think is unacceptable.
And I think the communication challenge we've got is that, as you're pointing out, is at least as difficult as the challenge of coming up with recommendations. And we're mindful of your comments, and we will keep them right in front of us. Appreciate that. Congressman Sanchez.
First, I'd like to start by commending the President for leadership on the National Export Initiative and all of my colleagues here today that are taking the time to work on this issue. And I just want to begin by saying that I support NEI just as strongly as everybody sitting at this table. And while I believe that we can probably agree on 90% of what we need to do prospectively to try to advance U.S. economic interests, I'm going to respectfully disagree with some of my colleagues about some of the FTAs. And exports and FTAs are closely tied. I share the goal of trying to double exports from the U.S. in 5 years. But some of the trade agreements that were negotiated under the preceding administration, I don't think are going to do a lot to help our economy or reduce our trade deficit in their current forms. And so my part of the puzzle is I work with my colleagues in Congress, and I'm interested in working with the administration and those of you here to try to find a way that we can spread those benefits to a broader base, because the trade agreements have brought some benefits, but the question is certain industries have certainly benefited in certain states, and other states not so much, or other workers have paid the price. So we can't afford to wholesale pursue an agenda that leaves certain people behind. So at a time when we're struggling with the economy to get it back on solid footing, we can't afford to risk exporting more jobs than exporting more products. I think that if we do trade in the right way, we can open up access to markets for business here in the United States, and not just big businesses that are already doing international trade, but medium and smaller businesses that have never really probably thought about exporting goods abroad. We need to make sure that they are sharing in those opportunities as well. And one thing that I just want to mention before I close, because I'm trying to be brief, is that we have a Make It in America agenda that we're working on in Congress right now, and that is a package of bills that are designed to try to strengthen manufacturing here in the United States, particularly by those small and medium-sized businesses. So I'd like to just draw everybody's attention to those package of bills that have a manufacturing strategy, some targeted tax cuts, and an infrastructure development bank as part of that. But aside from that, I want to say that I'm very excited to be here and really want to utilize the time wisely to try to help us arrive at a place where we can all agree on a strategy that is going to help move our country forward.
Thank you very much for your comments. Congressman Reichert, are you next, or do we want to go Congressman Schauer?
I also want to extend my thank you to Ursula and Jim for taking on this responsibility and in leading this group. I am pleased to be a part of this effort. I just have a couple of comments. All of us recognize the importance of opening new markets, otherwise we wouldn't be here. We recognize that if we don't do that, we lose jobs, and we continue to fall behind globally in this fast-moving global economy, and lose market share and market access to a lot of the countries around the world. I also want to applaud the President for his efforts here and being here to kick this effort off in doubling exports, and also in working to resolve the issues around the Korean trade agreement. In Washington State, one out of every three jobs, as the Secretary Locke knows, is directly related to a trade. And so for Washington State, it's very, very important for us to take a look at not only doubling exports through other means and some of the ways that we're going to explore in this group, but also in looking at the trade agreements that we haven't approved thus far. We haven't doubled our exports for years. The last time we did this was from 1995 to 2007. And there's one stark statistic that you'll all recognize when you look at that period of time. During that period of time, we passed 9 trade agreements. And I want to end with this. I agree with Ursula's comment in that we can't do everything. And so my last comment here relates to the trade letter that we'll be reviewing soon, in that there is some language there that I would just voice some concern or caution over, and that is the language that surrounds the modernization of existing agreements. I'm hoping that the word modernize doesn't equal reopen or renegotiate, because I think that sends it could send a very serious negative message to our partners in Korea, Colombia, and Panama, those three especially. So I would just I just caution using the word modernize and the message that that might send, and I think a focus on what we need to do is exactly what our vice chair said, and that is focus on doubling exports. I appreciate the opportunity to be a part of the group, and thank you for allowing me to comment.
That's a really good caution on that word modernization, and we still have time to shape that within the context of the letter, so I appreciate that. We don't want to put it at risk. I got Congressman Schauer, would you comment?
Yeah. Chairman, Madam Vice Chair, I'm Mark Schauer, member of Congress from Michigan. I'm from Battle Creek, which is the home of a large global company. And I am honored to serve with all of you on the President's Export Council. I commend the President and his entire administration on this initiative to help create 2 million more export jobs in the U.S. I just want to make sure we don't lose as many or more jobs in the process. I want to share some concerns about free trade agreements and trade. My state, I'm sure you would argue the same about yours, but my state of Michigan has the best workers, the best innovators, the best manufacturers, and the best farmers in the world. But I am concerned, particularly about South Korea, that we don't lock in non-tariff trade barriers, disadvantages that hurt manufacturing, particularly the automotive sector. I share very real concerns about China. In fact, I'm working on legislation. My good friend Senator Stabenow is also working on an issue. But China's government, I want to be clear, China's government is allowing currency to be manipulated, intellectual property to be reappropriated. China's failed to sign the government procurement agreement when it entered WTO, it was 9 years ago. China continues to subsidize its own renewable energy companies for the purposes of exports to us, which is a clear WTO violation. You know, this is about jobs, and we've lost 2.4 million jobs in this country to unfair trade with China since they joined the WTO. And we've lost 4.9 million jobs in this country due to NAFTA-style free trade agreements since 94. So I'm deeply concerned about the further deterioration of our middle class. That concerns you, since you want healthy domestic markets to sell your products as well. So in closing, I've got great companies, small and large, back home in my district, that are ready to compete with anybody. They just want to have a chance, and I look forward to working with all of you to make sure that they can help accomplish the President's objective and put people to work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Congressman. I think now, with those comments in mind, I'd like to acknowledge the attendance of three Cabinet members. Obviously, Secretary Locke and Secretary Vilsack and Secretary LaHood have joined us here. Very much appreciate your presence and commitment. I think we'd all like to hear from Secretary Locke now as sort of our leader in this endeavor. So, Secretary Locke, do you have a few comments?
Well, thanks a lot, Jim. And Ursula, thank you very much for co-chairing or serving as the vice chair of the President's Export Council. And To all the members of Congress, I know how important your schedules are with only a few weeks left in the session, and I know that our senators had to leave take on a critical vote, and that's why we gave all of you the opportunity to make some opening comments. I want to thank all the members of the Council for serving and taking time out of your busy schedules to be here in Washington, D.C. The companies and the workers that you represent are successfully producing and selling world-class goods and services all around the world. Indeed, American products and services are highly valued and in great demand all around the world. And as many of our members of Congress said, I mean, American workers make great products and provide great services. And having the benefit of your expertise gives us a real-world perspective on the ways to advance the President's Export Initiative goal of doubling U.S. exports over the next 5 years, supporting some 2 million new jobs in the process. As you all know, that's a goal of critical importance, because as American consumers spend a little less and save a little bit more, it's imperative that U.S. businesses connect to the 95% of the world's consumers who live outside the borders of the United States. So if U.S. companies want to grow, if we want more jobs for American workers, we've got to realize where that demand is and where the market is. And a lot of that is outside the borders of the United States. And today, thanks to a strengthening global economy and also to efforts across the federal government, increasingly we're seeing that happen. Exports are actually leading our economic recovery. Here's a quick snapshot of where we are. As the President indicated, exports are up 18% over the same period last year. U.S. exports of manufactured goods are actually up 22%, to be more precise, in 2010 compared to the same period in 2009. U.S. agricultural exports are projected to be the second highest in U.S. history, and next year could actually be the highest ever. And in agriculture, as Secretary Vilsack would say, we actually have a trade surplus at some in agriculture at $30 billion this year compared to $25 billion last year. Exports, and all of these numbers have an impact on the economy. Exports accounted for more than 1 percentage point of GDP growth in each of the four quarters of recovery. And this is actually equal to our domestic activities as part of our domestic or as part of our economic recovery. And as the President said, the more we export, the more companies produce. And the more they produce, the more people they hire to produce those products and services. Since January, Commerce's Advocacy Center, in close cooperation with the State Department and other federal agencies, has assisted U.S. companies to successfully compete for foreign contracts to a tune of some $11.8 billion in U.S. export content. And this amount of export content alone supports an estimated 70,000 jobs in America. This 11.8 so far this year compares to $3.8 billion in U.S. export content through the advocacy efforts last year. And these successes are mirrored across a whole host of federal agencies. You know, since January, Commerce Department has coordinated some 19 trade missions abroad, resulting in what those companies that have been on those trade missions predict will be $2 billion in export sales, twice the value of last year. We've recruited some 8,600 foreign buyers to U.S. trade shows since January, a more than 50% increase over last year, leading to some $660 million in sales by U.S. companies. The Agriculture Department has recruited over 1,500 foreign buyers since January, and the State Department has developed a model for U.S. ambassadors to participate in these reverse trade missions, with the first mission scheduled for October of 2010. Ex-Exim Bank, presided over by Fred Hochberg, who's here, has more than doubled its loan authorizations in the first half of the current fiscal year over the same period last year, from $5.9 billion to $13.2 billion, with the number of jobs supported almost doubling as well. But we can, and indeed we must, do more. When you look at Germany, their GDP, 50% of their GDP comes from exports, compared to 11% in the United States. Today, we're unveiling the National Export Initiative report to the President, and the report represents the Export Cabinet's plan on how we intend to achieve the President's goal of doubling exports. A few highlights. First, for small and medium-sized businesses, the engines of American job growth, the report recommends a national outreach campaign led by the Small Business Administration and other federal agencies to raise awareness of export opportunities and government assistance available to U.S. small and mid-sized companies who have never exported before. Additionally, we're going to relaunch export.gov, the government's export internet portal. It's going to have new export training opportunities to help companies learn how they can begin selling their products overseas and break into new markets if they're already exporting. The report also recommends an important step for commercial advocacy. It actually proposes a formal system in which the White House and the National Economic Council would receive quarterly updates on critical pending business deals with foreign governments. And that will help level the playing field for our companies, allowing the White House to actually engage with their counterparts in other countries where U.S. companies have these pending deals, where U.S. companies are vying for these government contracts. And it'll also enable the White House to enlist other high-ranking officials throughout the administration to help American firms seal these job-creating business deals. Finally, the report recommends a government-wide export promotion strategy for six newly designated next-tier markets: Colombia, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Turkey, and Vietnam, where we all expect very strong economic growth during the next decade. The President touched on this, and I know that this is in part of the letters of recommendation, but I want to indicate to you that the administration is very serious in streamlining and simplifying our export control system and making it more transparent. We've actually made incredible progress in this effort, in this domain, and we hope to do a lot of this stuff as urged by the members of Congress via executive order, but we also have proposals that will require some congressional approval. And second, last Friday, I announced the new 11-member board of the Corporation for Travel Promotion, which is charged with encouraging travel to the United States. The travel and tourism industry accounts for 24% of all U.S. service exports and 8% of our total exports. When those foreign visitors come, they're actually spending money. So it's foreign visitors, foreign folks spending money here in the United States, the same way as if we were to ship the goods to them in a foreign destination. And we're counting on the Corporation for Travel Promotion to play a big role in helping us reach the National Export Initiative goal, again, of doubling U.S. exports over the next 5 years. With the measures outlined in the report that we've just submitted to the President and the continued worldwide economic recovery, I'm very confident that we're going to reach that goal. And we're going to have to build on the success we've already seen to help repair America's economic foundation. And all of you are an important, critical part of that endeavor. And we want we intend to give very careful consideration to all of your recommendations. Again, the more you can be precise, the more measurements, quantifiable goals that you can give us, I think that would be more certainly a good yardstick by which we can judge our performance and we can measure our progress. So again, thank you very much for your time and for your service, and we look forward to working with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. You know, there is an overlap between what you just described on the Export Promotion Cabinet's plan slash challenge and what we're all trying to do, which is to fill in some of the actionable elements of some of the strategic challenges that you've outlined, and we're going to rise to that challenge. I should have recognized Chairman Hochberg. I didn't see you down there. I'm sorry, I didn't recognize you earlier. I think let's turn to the business of the day. I think, as most of you know, we have four initial letters of recommendations coming from the subcommittees. We have a pipeline of additional items that will be coming forth in the next couple of meetings, but we decided to focus on these four. Just for perspective, they, in and of themselves, total about $250 billion of impact, and the pipeline we have behind that is significantly more. Again, responding to the challenge that the Gary and the President have given us. So I think I would now like to call on Bill Height, the chair of Workforce Readiness Subcommittee. Bill, where are you? I'm looking around. There you go, Bill. Bill, your Veterans Retraining Initiative, which in many respects is more fine-tuned with more actionable items in it than perhaps any of the recommendations. You've been giving it some thought to understate the case, but could you please present your recommendation?
Well, as the President alluded to, we're going to have a lot of returning veterans coming back from Iran and Afghanistan. And let's face it, they're laying it on the line every day to protect our freedom. And I think we have a responsibility to try to place them in the workforce. Two programs that my union's involved with, one is Helmets to Hard Hats. That's with a bunch of other unions, the building trades, the machinists are in it, and other unions. That's taking veterans and placing them into programs when they get discharged. But my organization has taken it to the next step. We have what we call a UAVIP program, and VIP stands for Veterans in Piping. And we've actually went out and made deals and worked out arrangements with the different branches of the military to set up training on active military bases for a career after the military. And no one has ever done that before in corporate America or any other union. We've been doing it for over a year with the National Guard in the state of Washington. We're at Camp Pendleton in California, and we're firing up a program at Camp Lejeune. We're going to be in San Diego with the Navy in the not-too-distant future, and we're also going to start it up in Fort McCoy, which is in Wisconsin, an Army base. And what it's all about is we go out there, we send out feelers who'd be interested in joining our union, and we give them 16 weeks of advanced training right on the base. We bring in trailers, we bring in instructors, we provide everything there. We even have to pay for our own electricity on the base, and we have to get insurance for the soldiers, for the military people, when they're coming back and forth to the barracks to our training, because we're outside the military. But you know, through it all, we worked it out. It's a very expensive program, and we pay for the whole thing lock, stock, and barrel, but we've been very successful. And we give them 16 weeks of heavy-duty training, and then when they can pass basic tests and they're discharged, we put them out in the workforce and we give them 4 more years of training. We give them 1 year credit toward their apprenticeship for going through our training, and then we give them 4 more years of training. And I'll tell you what, they are the best recruits that we have out there. When they come in there, they're disciplined, they take orders well, you know, they show up for work on time. They're great recruits, and I think we owe it to them. And we have hundreds of these veterans in our program, right, that came out of our program that are in the workforce right now, and it couldn't be working out better. And something like that could be expanded immensely, I mean, because it's a great pool of people to pull from. And, you know, the sky's the limit. People come out, they're working in manufacturing, or they're working in construction. Hey, they can be a foreman, they can be a general foreman, they can be a supervisor, they can get into engineering, they can get into design. Heck, they can even open their own company sometime. So it's a lot of opportunity. And Senator Brown, he alluded to, yeah, we need more people in manufacturing, but I don't want my sons and daughters involved. Well, I kind of disagree with that. When I started in this trade, I was 18 years old, and the average age was 19 or 20. Now, when we take in new apprentices, the average age is 27 to 28. And you'd be shocked how many of these young men and women have college degrees. They realize the benefit of a good manufacturing job or a good construction job. You know, everybody's not going to work on computers or be involved in the service industry. We need people in this country who can work with their hands, plain and simple. And it's been a very successful program that I'd like to see expand. We have other programs. We work a similar program with the Native Americans. We're going to be doing this, getting into the green technology. We traded a training for energy audits. We want to get into that green. And I think it's a very good program that we could take it to the next level and develop it. But the main thing is, when you train these young men and women, you have to have jobs available. Because if you train them and they're done with their training, and they got to sit for 4 months before they get a job, you're going to lose them. They go out, they hang out with their friends, they start feeling sorry for themselves, and they lose that competitive edge. So you got to place them right away. And you know, the program's been highly successful for us, and it's a program that I think that this council should look into hot and heavy for getting the workforce of the future. The American workers are the most highly productive workers in the world. And we have a workforce here that is ready to take on the challenge of the future as far as export's concerned. And yeah, the Congressman made the comment about exports. People don't like to hear the word exports, but they don't want to hear the words exports coming in from China. They don't want to hear about Chinese exports. But the American people would love to know that we are exporting goods and services over to China. And we're trying to level that trade imbalance. And that's what we're here for. It's about creating manufacturing jobs here in the United States and increasing exports and getting America back to work and good, high-paying jobs. We can't be subservient to other countries. We just got to do whatever we got to do to be successful.
Well, Bill, this idea is rooted in the best of all things, which is a best proven practice that we now can expand to other areas, other kinds of jobs, teamwork with companies, and get some financial support behind a greater effort. And that's what his letter is all about. So, are there any comments? Yes.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I hope that as this idea is developed, that agriculture and the appreciation of the need for a workforce within agriculture, both in terms of farming and in terms of packaging and processing, is not forgotten.
Okay.
It seems to me that it might be expanded to include not just the Departments of Veterans Affairs, Education, and Labor, but agriculture. We have a serious issue with workforce in agriculture. We have a serious aging of farmers in this country. We have veterans who are currently working in Afghanistan and Iraq with Afghan and Iraqi farmers to encourage more agriculture in those countries. And this is an area where I think you can encourage entrepreneurship and innovation as well. And as Secretary Locke indicated, it is a place where we do have a competitive edge worldwide. So if it wouldn't be too much to ask, agriculture would like to be included.
We'll be sure and include it, Mr. Secretary. Are there any other comments? Okay, if not, the council seems in general agreement here, and unless there is an objection, I propose we submit the letter to Secretary Locke for submission on to the President. Any objections? Hearing none, the letter is approved. Next, I would like to call on Dick Friedman, co-chair of the Manufacturing Services and Agricultural Subcommittee. Dick?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. All of us who attended yesterday's meeting with Secretary Geithner, everybody was talking there about the potential of business in Brazil, China, India, et cetera. It's huge. The news on the travel front is really good news in the following sense. Of all the issues that this PEC is dealing with, the travel piece is kind of like the simplest and the easiest and something that can really put as many as a million people to work in short order. If you take a look at the big picture, overseas travel in the world post 9/11 is up 31%. We're down 9.1% in the US. We had 23 million visitors here last year. And Spain, that's one for every, whatever. I was in Spain last weekend. Spain has one visitor per person, twice as many people go to Spain as come to the United States. Kind of weird. The world wants to come here. Why don't they come? We have not had effective promotion of tourism. This Tourism Promotion Board has been signed by the President in March, sets forth a public-private partnership which has to raise money. We have spent less money on promoting the United States than any other country in the world. In many countries, there's a cabinet minister of tourism. So this tourism promotion is part of it. Second part of it is we have 36 visa-waived countries.
I like to talk in my business about things that are bad, not good, because that's what we fix. The Bush administration added 8 countries to the visa waiver program. We have added none. There are several countries out there that are potential additions to the visa waiver program. It makes it much easier for people to be able to come. The non-visa waiver countries, in particular Brazil, India, China, have incredible horror stories about how hard it is to get a visa. Incredible. And those are result from delays at the State Department in obtaining visas. I went on the website for the State Department last night, and if you want to get a visa in Shanghai, your first appointment is November 2nd. Your first appointment. And by the way, you might have to travel 1,000 miles to get there or something like that to go and obtain, to ask for a visa and have a 2-minute interview with an officer. These officers interview 100 people a day, I believe, at mid-80 in a 2-minute interview, which could be done by video. There's lots of solutions to this, high-tech and other solutions. In fact, I have a letter from a congressman in Vermont. Some Chinese people wanted to buy a business in Vermont and hire 50 people. And they went to Shanghai and asked for a visa. They were told they couldn't get one. They had to do it in the summer. And the letter from the visa officer back to the congressman says, why don't you people go to Chengdu? And Chengdu is 1,200 miles away. They can get a visa in like 2 weeks shorter time or 3 weeks shorter time. It's ridiculous. And so these horror stories are everywhere. Amway had a meeting of 13,000 people for all their people from around the world who have done well. They couldn't get visas. They canceled it. They held the meeting in Singapore. There's religious groups that can't get here. There's people who can't visit their families, et cetera. So there's problems that exist in Homeland Security and in State Department and in promotion. But they are readily resolvable problems. They can be solved largely by the people within this room. And if we do this, we can double the number of people that come to the United States easily, easily, and create something on the order of 500,000 to 1 million jobs in a year or two. So I think it's I've been digging into this. People want to come to America. They want to come for cultural reasons, for medical reasons. I have a hotel in Boston that's next to Mass General Hospital. Their medical tourism, people coming to Mass General, virtually dried up because people say, the heck with it, I'll go to Germany or I'll go somewhere else. So we've got to make it easier. We've got to make it friendlier at our borders. People are afraid to go through the borders. They're afraid of the intimidation. But these are all very solvable problems if Commerce, State, Homeland Security, and others work together. I think we'd be very optimistic. Our letter essentially says this in less eloquent language than I just used, but I think this is ought not to be very controversial. It covers every part of the country. Tourism goes from plumbing to accountants to people buying airplanes and cars, and a lot of these people are coming here to buy goods or do things. So this is something we really ought to attack. We've been a country that basically has had a big do not enter sign for too long, and we've overreacted to the 9/11 situation, and we've got to get people to come here.
If the letter's as convincing as you are, we're in pretty good shape. I think, are there any comments? Did Bob Iger or Secretary LaHood want to offer? Bob?
What Dick says. The growth of the middle class in markets like China, India, Brazil has created a huge demand in those countries for family travel. Families in those countries would love to visit the United States. We export brand Disney, but brand U.S. is also very attractive. But the United States has to be our partner. In a market like Brazil, Dick mentioned people having to go 1,000 miles or more just to get a visa. Every member of the family has to make that trip. That means a family of four who may want to travel to Walt Disney World in Orlando, God bless them, has to bring the entire family on a 1,000-mile trip just to get a visa. For a 2-minute, by the way, and it is a 2-minute interview. It just doesn't happen. And there's huge demand for these people to visit the U.S. We know that tourism creates jobs. They also come here and spend a fair amount of money, as has been said, and I can't be more supportive of this initiative.
Yeah.
A particular city in Brazil, Manaus, has a direct flight to the United States, but you have to travel 1,000 miles to get a visa. But there's a direct flight to the U.S.
Well, the aerospace industry is in good shape. It's just the other stuff we got to fix. I couldn't hear you. You're breaking up. Listen, are there any other comments? Yes, Raul. Yeah.
I noticed Mr. Tilton's not here, but I've taken his proxy on my own volition and triple or second or third or whatever the letter.
Okay. Yeah. Any other comments? Okay, hearing none, I think there's a general consensus to move forward with this letter, and we will have an opportunity to shape and flesh it out as the committee moves forward. So hearing no objections, we will approve the letter. Now, let me call on Andrew Liveris, Chair of the Global Competitiveness Subcommittee. Andrew?
For those of you who can gather the accent, I'm an Australian citizen, so I'm very privileged to serve this country and very proud of it. I've spent 20 years of my life living in Asia and the last 10 years in the state of Michigan, and I would agree with the comments of the congressman about the quality of the workforce in Michigan and the Midwest. My company is an investor in the United States and an investor in Michigan, and I would like to pick up on the topic of the free trade agreement letter, but just to make sure we get a context, the committee's global competitiveness. So we will have to address the topics that were raised by all congressmen and women, and for that matter, the senators, which is really how do we compete on all aspects of competition, which means tax, regulatory, and many other issues, including energy. That's bigger than all outdoors, but it is the topic of our time. American multinationals employ directly 22 million workers in the country, and another 41 million in small and medium enterprises support those multinationals. 63 million workers, that's glass half full, not glass half empty. 38 million of those jobs depend on trade. So we really need to figure out to stop the atrophy of jobs, but we've got to protect those jobs and grow them. So the guts of the committee will be to work on all those issues, and therefore if you take this letter and what's in this letter, it's to be responsive to the president's call to move forward with deliberation, intensity, content quality, incorporating the topics of our time, which are human rights, worker rights, but of course making sure at the same time that we have a level playing field as we go forward with key trading partners. And one of the most important ones to deal with are our allies. And clearly this is a matter of security. Korea is an ally. Korea is on our side. Korea wants this. We want it. So we need to be responsive to that. This letter, I believe, has incorporated many comments from many of you, if not all of you, representing all aspects of the American workforce and American industry, and of course, agriculture. There are still issues, like autos, like beef, that we have to go get at, that we rely on Ambassador Kirk and our negotiators to make sure we do get at it. I had an opportunity to talk to the ambassador a few minutes before we came in here, and I know they're on those topics. We have to be responsive, I think, to other free trade agreements. The ones that the chairman referenced and the secretary referenced, I think, are very positive. But we have to get some wins. There are 400 free trade agreements scheduled for completion this year. We're participating in three of them as a country. Okay? China alone is participating in 17. Okay? So we can't not be in world trade. I mean, obviously, I'm stating the obvious. So this letter is to be responsive to that call for action. It's not perfect. I think the modernization term and taking that out, I would be responsive to that, Mr. Chairman. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I would like to stop because I would like to keep my introduction reasonably brief and really, because this is a very important letter, be responsive to any inputs.
Okay, I think we've had a chance to review the letter. Are there any comments?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Pat?
I would like to offer two thoughts in support of what Andrew said and build on a couple of topics related to agriculture. As we know, agriculture is a major contributor to exports in this country, and the U.S. farmer plays a vital role in feeding the world. As Secretary Locke mentioned, in fiscal 2011, it's expected that global exports or agricultural exports from this country will reach $113 billion, and the trade surplus related to agriculture to exceed $31 billion. So a very positive story related to agriculture. But U.S. agriculture's market share has dropped in these countries that we talk about free trade agreement needing to reach these agreements. So a quick fact for you, for every $1 billion of additional agricultural exports, 8,000 to 9,000 more jobs. So as agricultural exports grow, certainly jobs grow in this country. And passage of these FTAs, we think, is important for that competitiveness to continue. Thank you.
Keeping in mind, yes,
Jim. Support what Andrew says. I was struck by when Dick said he prefers to think about and talk about the bad, not the good, because you could impact the bad. One example of the bad is that it seems to me that while we've been negotiating and debating these free trade agreements, other countries, as Andrew said, have been executing them and entering into them. My understanding is by the end of 2010, there will probably be about 600 bilateral, multilateral agreements. I think the U.S. is party to less than 20 of those. And so, I mean, this is a very real and present issue. I was talking to one of our clients, Baldor Electric Company, told me I could feel free to talk about his situation, sent me an email on it, actually. And it's fascinating. Manufacturing company, middle of Arkansas. They make industrial motors. They make gearboxes for electric motors, whatnot. And they've got some 20 plants in the United States. They've got plants in six other countries, or a dozen other countries, I think, including one in Mexico. And it's fascinating because when they are trying to sell industrial motors in Panama, they're faced with a 10% duty. When their competitors, mostly from Brazil, mostly from Mexico, are doing the same thing, they're faced either with no duty or 4.5% duty. They're at a real disadvantage. They move into the gearbox business, and they're doing the same thing, gearboxes, into Colombia, and Baldor is faced with a 15% duty. Competitors, zero duty. What's interesting in Baldor's case, they can make these gearboxes in Mexico and send them straight to Colombia on an even-keel basis, but that's not what they want to do. They want to make them here in this country and export them. These things have real impact. This is one micro example that plays out again and again and again, and I think we've got to really deal with this issue urgently.
Okay, appreciate it. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Congressman Schauer.
And I have great respect for fellow Michigander there. I don't know if you've met David Mackay, the CEO of Kellogg, fellow Australian. Form a support group, I'm proud to have you. I was at your plant in Hillsdale just last week, a very, very impressive operation. I have great respect for the work that you're doing, the leadership of this very, very important committee. Some of the items in the letter in terms of reinforcing American rights against unfair trade practices, fixing or improving, apparently not modernize, but I'll say improve current trade agreements, examining a more modern adjustment process is very encouraging. I do have concerns about what I would interpret as rushing the South Korea free trade agreement. So I respect your work. I can't support the letter as before the council at this time. I will watch and participate with your work in every way that I can, but I just wanted to offer those comments and my reservation at this time.
I understand it. Congressman Sanchez?
I'll be very brief, and I'm going to echo the concerns of my colleague, Mr. Schauer. And there is a, after careful study of the letter, there is an alternate letter that we have written, and that's been transmitted. So as long as that's been received, I'll stop.
I understand. It will be received, and we will try to be responsive to it. And some of your comments earlier anticipated some of this, and so I think we got it and appreciate your sensitivities.
Sorry,
here.
Mr. Chairman, I have a process question.
Yes.
So as the letters are approved with some of the recommended changes, are we going to get copies of those before they go forward, or what's?
No, I was recommending approval of the letters as written from the committee, and the extent to which there is disagreement, there would be a side letter that we would consider and make part of a package, part of the record.
Okay, thank you.
Secretary Locke? Is that,
however you want to run it.
Yes. I think the comment should be noted. Yes. Was there another one? Yes.
Yes. Thank you. There's been a lot of comments this morning about small and medium-sized businesses, and that's who I am.
Our company is headquartered in Iowa, and we have about 2,300 employees worldwide, so small to medium size, but 90% in the United States. And my dad started the company, and one of our first exports was a trenching piece of equipment, which was used in Europe, and he went and did the operator instruction himself. But through the years, really, most of our business has been the United States. In the last 10 years, however, we've gone from about 10% of our business being exported to 30% being exported. So one in every three jobs, and we talk about this a lot with our employees, one in every three jobs has to do with export. And so it's really important for us to be understanding of what the customer needs are internationally. And when I look at where we're exporting the most to, the biggest chunk is to Australia. We've had the most growth in Australia, and it correlates with the 2005 free trade agreement. So I know there's things we need to work out, and we need to look at all the issues, but I would say that for us, free trade agreements are a huge deal, and also just to reflect a little bit on the visa comments from the earlier letter, we often, when we bring customers in from various countries, and we can show them our plants, our people, they can go see equipment demonstrated in real sites with other contractors, they buy our equipment and we can export it. But if we can't get them here because of visa issues, you know, we miss that opportunity. So anyway, I think we have a great opportunity here, and I just heard a little comment the other day, which I think maybe applies, that if the pace of change inside an organization, and I think that applies to the United States, if the pace of change inside our country is a lot less than the pace of change outside, we've got an irrelevancy factor. And so I just urge us not, you know, to make sure that this is an urgency. The pace of change for a lot of things, 600 lateral agreements around the world, and we've got 20. We're getting behind the ball. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other specific comments on the letter, Mr. Secretary?
Very quickly, I think there's been a lot of emphasis on new and emerging markets, but I hope that in the draft of this letter that we don't forget about our longstanding partners in trade, that being Canada and Mexico, and the need for us to make sure that as actions are taken, be they statutory or regulatory, that we don't interfere with that. Those relationships. And I know that Ray LaHood and I probably agree that we need to resolve the Mexican trucking issue, for example, because they have assessed tariffs on a number of agricultural products that have made it a bit more difficult for us to export to Mexico, who is one of our best trading partners. So I hope in the emphasis that this letter seems to have on new and emerging markets that we don't send the wrong message to our current trading partners who are so valuable to us.
Okay. We'll review that. Thank you. Any other comments on the letter per se? Okay. With some modifications in mind as to language, my sense is letter going forward, understand there will be another letter that will be considered in parallel. Without objection, we approve the letter. Ambassador, did you want to make a comment before we moved on to the next?
Yes. Jim, I'm Ambassador Shapiro from USTR, one of Ambassador Kirk's deputies, and he unfortunately had a prior speaking commitment, which is why he asked me to step in. I just want to thank everyone for what's been a terrific discussion, because all of the issues that you've raised, from Representative Sanchez to Senator Stabenow to all of the terrific CEO representation that we have here, are issues that we are working on every single day of the year. So I just want to reassure you that what you're saying is very much what is on our plate. We know that U.S. exporters are suffering when our trading partners don't live up to their commitments and when the playing field is not level. So we are incredibly committed to enforcing all of our rights overseas, and we're doing that all the time. We're also fighting to win new market access every day from innovative new models like the Trans-Pacific Partnership to working to resolve outstanding issues with Korea, with Panama, with Colombia, to re-energizing the Doha process with 153 countries now in the WTO. It's quite a challenge, but we're working on access for manufacturers, for services, for agriculture. So again, these issues are very much front and center of what we're doing, including emphasis on small and medium enterprises, digital goods, green technology. So please keep your ideas coming, and let's keep in touch and work these issues through together. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Shapiro. Appreciate the comments. Certainly, not least but last, I'd like to call on a good customer of mine, by the way, Scott Davis, Chair of the Export Promotion and Advocacy Subcommittee. Scott?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. You know, our topic is regarding export controls reform, and I'd say much needed export controls reform. I believe a lot less controversial than Andrew's topic, I think, for anybody who's dealt with export controls in the past. The President referred to the Export Control Reform Program this morning in opening remarks. We applaud the administration's efforts in this area, and we urge the administration to stay focused on continuing this reform. For anybody who's dealt with export controls, you understand the challenges of the current system. We have two separate U.S. export control regimes, both the Defense State Department and the Commerce Department. We have separate commodity control lists. We have separate licensing agencies. We have lots of overlap, overly complicated, and still does not sufficiently reduce the national security risks today. So again, I think this export control reform has potential to better secure critical technologies, build the U.S. industrial base, and maintain the competitiveness of U.S. companies abroad. And we've talked a lot about manufacturing jobs. I think this really will assist in growing manufacturing jobs in the U.S. So we really had three recommendations in the letter. The first really is just getting a more formalized process for obtaining expert feedback on proposed regulatory changes. And what we would say is that we should start with getting greater involvement by the PEC Subcommittee on Export Administration, Raul's subcommittee. And I know he's just forming the committee today, but I think that's a group that should be very much involved in the discussions, and probably the entire PEC should be involved for feedback. Second, the Export Control Reform Initiative really can be aided by improving the technology release program. Secretary Gates has noted that we need to move towards a system that builds higher walls around fewer systems. It makes a lot of sense. Right now, there's too many walls around too many systems. If things are actually critical to defense, we need to build bigger walls and protect that. Finally, back to in line with the small business needs, I think because of the complexity of this thing, we have to allow for more outreach and assistance to small business to comply with the export laws and the regulations. If we're going to double the exports in the U.S. next 5 years, a lot of it's got to come from the small and medium-sized enterprises. We have to make it easier. Mm-hmm. So overall, again, export control reform should provide clarity, reduce redundancy, strengthen security, and promote exports. And those are the recommendations we included in the letter.
Are there any comments on Scott's proposal, which is very much in alignment and supportive of, I think, Secretary Locke, your thrust here, which is very important. Hearing no comments or objections, I think it's the sense of the group that we adopt the letter. So we will so adopt it. The letter is approved. Listen, I'd like to thank the subcommittee chairs for a fast start, some quick contributions, some quick hits early. We had a fair amount to get through, and so I appreciate the efficiency and the staff that supported us, which, as we all know, really are the people that got us through this. I'd like to acknowledge them and thank them very much. Before asking Dr. Summers for a quick comment or two as he observes and helps guide us, are there any other general comments anyone would like to make on any topic before asking Larry to say something? Raul, would you like to say something?
Yeah. I spent my morning yesterday with the Bureau of Industry and Security, and I'll work really hard to keep it simple, stupid, and not violate the security part of that, because, you know, I am an Army veteran, and my job in the Army was nuclear surety, so I understand the other side of that. So, and I'm a small businessman, too, so we're going to work hard at getting that done. I assure you.
Appreciate the comments. Yes, yeah, Bob.
I don't know if this is the appropriate time, but you asked for comments. Just for future consideration, a letter regarding intellectual property protection.
Yeah.
We're global leaders in the creation of intellectual property, whether we're talking about computer software or making movies. We compete in many countries with pirates who are either giving away our product for free, tough to compete against free, or selling it for their own gain at substantially reduced prices and not paying any taxes, by the way, in the United States for those sales. And I just think, given the size of the industry, the fact that we're global leaders, obviously the importance to this country in terms of the support of the economy, it's something we need to consider.
Bob, we couldn't agree more. I think for our December 9th meeting, we're going to all work together on a strong letter there, and you have our commitment to do that. I think the other thing I know that's on the agenda for December 9th is Gene's initiative, Gene Hale's initiative with small and medium-sized enterprise. He's got an outreach program that he's modeled in, or modeling, I would say, in Southern California that we hope sort of is at the same status that Bill's recommendation was, which was we got a proven best practice that we now want to expand. And I think Gene's got some ideas on how to engage all of us in that. And I'll just leave it at that for now. But it's very promising. And the president did comment on it this morning when he was just informally interacting. So you've
location pick for the December 9th, or is that still to be
served? I'm not sure exactly. It's right here.
Okay. We're trying to keep these meetings aligned with BRT meetings to sort of maximize the travel disruption. And as a matter of fact, one of the things we're gonna work on is the schedule into next year, and we'll have that ready before the December 9th meeting.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir. Yes.
Just one additional comment. As we talk about small and medium-sized businesses, I hope that we also are particularly sensitive to the needs of minority-owned businesses.
Yeah.
We have found in agriculture that there is a perception that export opportunities are not available or not easily available to minority-owned businesses. And I think as we try to figure out strategies to help small and medium-sized businesses, we need to understand that there may be an additional hurdle for some of those businesses. And it would be helpful, I think, to...
I don't want to put words in Gene's mouth, but I know that is very much at the forefront of the things he's trying to identify and knock down as part of his... And some of them are a lot more practical than you would think. Yeah.
We're developing a comprehensive plan to include minorities. Matter of fact, the round tables that we are proposing for, that we will have on September the 30th, we will have two of them, one in Long Beach, California, and later in the day, one in Los Angeles. And we intend to bring together all of those parties to participate in this round table to identify those companies you speak of.
Appreciate your leadership there, Gene. It's important. So maybe one more comment before asking Larry to say something.
Just on committee charters, subcommittee charters, we need to get our heads together around that, Jim, because intellectual property cuts across all the committees. We just need to make sure we don't get redundant work. So whether it be export control standards and technology standards, rising tide lifts all boats, global competitiveness, services, manufacturing, and agriculture all have a stake in that. So just to, I think we should get some clarity around that from the staff.
Reduce the complexity and get a letter done. Yeah, appreciate the comment, though, and I do understand the challenge there. Dr. Summers, do you have a comment as you reflect on the meeting?
Let me respond very briefly on each of the letters, and then make a final comment. I'll be very brief. On training, we can only agree. It is a huge issue, probably the most important issue for the long run. It is illustrative of a broader principle. Doing the right things to make our companies more competitive will also make them better exporters. And the right domestic policy, if there were no exports, it would be crucial to do training right. And there are a set of things like that, and we need to identify them and be working on them very hard. My guess is that the single largest lacuna in a 25-year basis in the U.S. effort around competitiveness is actually in the tourism area, where I think we just lag way behind. There's a massive coordination problem in terms of no individual has an incentive to promote in the right way, and it's not what people think of when they think of exports. Without getting into economic forecasting of a kind I shouldn't, the current levels of excess capacity in the lodging industry and developments in foreign exchange markets suggest to me that this is probably a particularly propitious time for a substantial initiative in tourism, and I think there's a lot of receptiveness to that in the administration, and you have to help show us how. I will not at this late hour relitigate the various issues associated with trade policy beyond observing that we have to demonstrate that these agreements work for people if we're going to succeed in doing them, and that means bringing them back to the interests of ordinary workers and ordinary people here. And just to repeat a hobby horse of mine, it does not help your government to tell it that foreign countries are doing outrageous things, but you can't really mention the outrageous things to the foreign government because they'll retaliate. And if the business community can find a way to allow there to be disputes raised collectively, that will be very important. Export controls, look, this debate is in a different place. This theme has been there for 25 years. It is in a different place now because the Secretary of Defense is leading the charge. And the Secretary of Defense institutionally is usually on the opposite side. We have a huge window of opportunity here, and it's a matter of just getting the word out. Insofar as some of you have interactions with the bureaucracies that sit underneath the kind of people who come to this table, you're conveying strength to those bureaucracies. Will be very helpful. One broad thought for reflection and one final conclusion. I think, and this is really a thought not for your next meeting, but for you to keep in mind over the next couple of years. There is a traditional paradigm of thinking about international trade, which is that it's trade in goods. Countries import some goods, they export other goods. Increasingly, as many of the companies around this table illustrate, what we have is trade in tasks. A product is produced, and it is produced in many different countries as an ultimate product. And it means, for example, that an import is a major component of an export. How else could Singapore's trade ratio be 300% of GDP? It goes to the role of global companies. It goes to the relationship between global companies and national interests. And I think our trade policy debates are a little bit behind the reality of cross-border integrated production. I honestly don't know where it leads, but I think a group like this should be thinking about that question. Final observation. It takes 2.5% GDP growth to keep employment growth consistent with population growth in the United States, or to put it differently, to keep the unemployment rate constant. Our progress in reducing unemployment depends on our excess above 2.5% growth over the next 4 years. My guess is that how we do on exports is probably the single largest component determining whether it's 2.7% growth or whether it's 4.3% growth, and that is the single most important determinant of whether we are successful in putting people work. It is hard for me to see how, if we are actually successful in doubling exports over the next 5 years, the economy will not have grown at 3.5% to 4%. And it is hard to see, hard for me to see how, if we fall far short of doubling, how we're going to have economic growth at a rate that's going to bring the unemployment rate down at anything that approaches one percentage point per year. So I don't think we have a more important economic challenge over the next 5 years than yours. Thank you.
Larry, thank you very, very much. The challenge and the context that you provided, I think, is going to provide energy to this group. And that one thought you had on product versus product, share of supply chain as a way to think about things, it's an interesting thought. It's an interesting thought. So I think that concludes our work for today. Ursula and I thank you very much for your participation and work, and we'll see you in December. The meeting is adjourned.